Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning, in this part of the show, we'll be talking about energy policy. The Bush administration has said that the United States needs to develop policies to make this nation less dependent on imported oil, and among other things, has called for an expansion of the nuclear generation of electricity. Right at the moment, nuclear plants supply 20% of the nation's electricity. The nuclear industry obviously thinks this is good news and says that it has the world's largest source of emission-free energy. However, opponents continue to give nuclear power failing grades on cost, on safety and security, and it is true that it has been a long time, 32 years to be precise, since the last nuclear reactor was ordered and built here in the United States. In this hour of Focus 580, we will be talking about nuclear generation and some of the concerns with our guest here, Cliff Singer. He is professor of nuclear plasma and radiation engineering at the University of Illinois. He is also director of the program in arms control, disarmament, and international security. And this is the first of, I expect, at least a couple of programs that we'll be doing on this issue with different guests who have different points of view. So we hope that you will stay tuned as we tackle this topic over the next couple of weeks, perhaps. And this is part of a kind of informal series that we had decided to do, looking at the issue of energy, energy policy, and various sources of energy here in the country. We've done one show just fairly recently on solar power, and we'll be doing taking a look at things like geothermal and wind. And we certainly are interested in input that people might have on what sort of subjects we might cover in the future. So here this morning on this part of the show, of course, questions are welcome, as always, 333-9455. We do have a toll-free line. Good anywhere you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Well, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
It's a pleasure to come.
I appreciate it. I'm not exactly sure where to start. Maybe I'll ask this question and again touch back to this fact that it has been now more than three decades since the last nuclear reactor was ordered and built in this country. It's been a long time since we built a plant. And if you ask people why that is, I'm sure you'll get different reactions. Everything from public concerns about the safety of those plants to, if you talk to people in the industry, I'm sure they will tell you that the problem is the expenses associated with dealing with all the regulations that go with building one of these plants. Why is it that it's been such a long time, more than 30 years?
Well, nuclear production capacity in the United States was basically overbuilt in the 1970s and 1980s compared to what would have happened in a less regulated market. Mm. It was really cheaper to make electricity from natural gas, but the natural gas market had been regulated, which artificially kept the price of natural gas up, and there have been various subsidies for the development of nuclear power, plus a certain amount of overenthusiasm in the industry. So the industry got saddled at that time with a lot of expensive plants that weren't running at full capacity because they hadn't learned how to operate them well enough to do that. At the same time, when natural gas prices were reducing due to deregulation and improvements in technology and transmission of natural gas.
Hmm. Well, now at this point, given the economics of today, does it make sense to think about once again building nuclear power plants?
That depends on whether you take a national perspective or an industry perspective. From the point of view of any particular power provider, it's too expensive to invest in the new generation of safer nuclear power plants. One or two have been built in Japan, but they need to be built in our current regulatory environment. So industry is telling the government, we think this is a great idea, but we don't want to pay for the startup costs. And so the government has turned around and said that they're willing to consider helping with the startup costs, and the industry is interested because natural gas prices are much higher than they were.
Mm. Well, it's interesting that this is something that, in fact, both people who represent the industry and the critics of nuclear power seem to agree on, the economic reality and the fact that the only way that we could get nuclear power started again, if we're talking about building new plants, is with subsidies from the government.
Well, either from the government or, in principle, the industry could pool its resources. That's operationally difficult in the current competitive environment and potential antitrust problems. So, of course, it's always easier to get the money from the government to come up with yourself in any case. Right?
Well, if you take the longer view, though, would you be able to make the argument that says, well, perhaps it makes sense for the government, and ultimately you're talking about us, to put the money up front to build new plants? Will we gain that back in the long run?
Well, that depends sensitively on the future of natural gas prices again. Mm-hmm. If you talked to any utility executive who said that of the current climate, there's no way I'm going to build a nuclear plant because it's not that much more expensive, maybe about the same price as, for example, a coal-fired plant. But the risk is much higher because you got a lot of capital in one place and you have to invest 3, 7, 10 years ahead of time in all that money before you start getting the money back. You build a natural gas plant, you can order it, put it online, and have it go in the next year,
mm-hmm.
or maybe two if you get regulatory. It takes regulatory approval. So it wasn't so much a matter of the cost, but the risk. And natural gas prices now are running really high. The industrial consumers are paying about $7 per 1,000 cubic feet. It's about twice as much as what they used to pay just 5 or 10 years ago. But that's a temporary phenomenon probably. Mm-hmm. And so the real question is, once we get new facilities online, more pipelines from Canada, Alaska, and liquefied natural gas terminals in Baja and Louisiana, and the price of natural gas comes down, how far will it come down and how long will it stay down before a global pressure on natural gas resources puts it back up again? It's a tough question.
Is there any natural constituency for building new power plants? It doesn't really even sound like within the industry there's all that much enthusiasm for the idea.
Well, they've been building new capacity. I mean, California had this tremendous shortage, and that's just in this country. In China, mm-hmm. they're building things like crazy. Mm-hmm. So, and it's a global industry, so what happens in China is relevant to what happens here.
Mm-hmm. One of the concerns, the big concerns I think a lot of people have, is the issue of safety. If we were to start building new plants today, in what way would the design of those plants be different from those that we built 30, 40 years ago?
Well, the basic safety question with a large-scale safety question with a nuclear power plant is that if you uncover the uranium in the core, then it can melt down and cause real mess. I mean, usually it doesn't get out of the containment facility, but it costs billions of dollars and it has a big cleanup problem and it can conceivably get out of the containment facility. And the current plants that we have in this country are designed so that you have to actually have electricity in the plant somehow from a backup generator or whatever to pour water on the core if somehow the piping ruptures and the regular water supply leaks out. The new, safer designs have got big water tanks that are gravity-fed that can just automatically flood the core if it ever gets uncovered, so that you don't even have to have a pump operating in the plant in order to keep the reactor from melting down. So it is now possible, if people decide to pay the money for that, to order these new plants, which are substantially safer than the ones we have now.
Hmm. But other than that, the basic idea that what you're doing is you're using fission to produce heat that heats water, that generates steam, that turns a turbine, that generates electricity. That's still basically what
it is.
That's
still just a teapot, right?
Yeah, indeed.
Fancy as it may seem, that's all it really is.
Let me again just mention our telephone number here. If people have questions, we're talking this morning about nuclear power plants as energy sources. Our guest is Cliff Singer. He's professor of nuclear plasma and radiation engineering at University of Illinois. Also, he happens to be director of the program in arms control, disarmament, and international security. Questions are certainly welcome here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Given that we are still talking about, as you just said, you're talking about a teapot, essentially, has anyone ever suggested any different sort of way of doing it? Or does it really not make sense to think about using that nuclear reaction to generate energy in any sort of different way?
Well, people are talking about directly making hydrogen with the heat rather than mm-hmm. making electricity. The economics of that are not very favorable at this point. So, and there are various ways of cooling the reactor. You can cool it with water. You can cool it with regular water. You can cool it with heavy water, which doesn't absorb neutrons as well. You can cool it with gas. But most of the power plants in the world are basically the tea kettle. You mm-hmm. use the neutrons to heat up water and use the fission energy to heat up water and very steam with it. And mm-hmm. so the concept's very simple. And those are the plants that are most likely to be put online in the near term and probably even in the next 20, 30 years.
Hmm. Do you think that the process, all the various regulatory hoops that the industry has to go through to build a plant, I think that they have had this long-term complaint that one of the reasons that it's so expensive is that the regulatory process is extremely complicated, maybe more complicated than it should be, and that drives up the cost. Is there any truth to that position that the industry takes that says, look, the government could just make this a little bit easier for us to build the plant, we could build it more quickly, it wouldn't cost as much money, it would make more economic sense in the end. So can you ease up on the regulations on building plants?
Well, there's a question of streamlining the process and making the process safe. Okay. Mm-hmm. The Clinton administration is not widely credited for being pro-nuclear, but actually really did a lot of work on streamlining the approval process so that instead of going through several steps, you can now do it in one integrated process. And so that's the process that will be used in the next round of nuclear power plant applications, if there are any. And so that's really been taken care of. It was a concern. There was a concern that the process wasn't good enough before the Three Mile Island accident. And so there was, of course, a reexamination of the entire system, which made the process more complicated. And then people looked at that process and said, well, we need this regulation in order to make sure that a competitive industry trying to make a buck is also operating safely, but we can make it go faster. And so that's basically been done and taken care of, and the system is ready to go on that.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's in round figures, what amount of time would you be looking at from if today we broke ground for a plant, between that point and when you actually would be generating power?
Yeah, they're shooting for 4 to 7 years, and it used to be 7 to 10. And so that's a tremendous difference. You got to carry $1 or $2 billion worth of investment over 3 years. That's a lot of interest costs. And so it makes a big difference whether it's 4 years, 7 years, or 10 years.
I guess I find myself thinking that one of the big concerns that people seem to have is the safety issue and the possibility that something would go wrong, there would be an accident, there would be a release of radioactivity outside of the plant. How worried about that should one be?
Well, there are two parts of the safety issue. One is the plant as operated going to operate safely and not put radiation in my environment? Mm-hmm. And the second question is, when the plant runs, it makes plutonium. What's going to happen to that plutonium and other radioactive waste when you're finished? A lot of the opposition to the expansion, global expansion of nuclear power, has to do with concerns about that it's going to end up in countries which are going to be able to make plutonium, which didn't used to be able to make plutonium. And countries like Iran, North Korea, and places in Africa and so forth. So the expansion of nuclear power, particularly beyond the states that are already making nuclear weapons, they already can blow up countries many times over. But the expansion of nuclear power to other places has always been a concern, and that's sort of boiled back into a concern about, well, what about the nuclear plutonium in our own country? Where is that going to go, and how are we going to make sure over the long time that nobody gets a hold of it and makes nuclear explosives out of it?
Mm. It sounds as if in your mind this question of the long-term storage of high-level radioactive waste that's generated by the plants that generate the electricity, there the big issue is it is a proliferation issue because you can take that material there and you can build nuclear weapons with it. So in some other country that doesn't already have weapons, that's a source of weapons-grade material. And here, for us, it's still an issue because it's not only is it extremely dangerous and you have to make sure that you keep it out of the environment, you also want to make sure that it is contained and protected and no one can go there and get some of that stuff and then take it and use that to build a weapon.
Right. And in a country like the United States, the protection of that material, which is not particularly good for making nuclear weapons, is really a small problem compared to protecting the 10,000 pits of nuclear explosive that we've already made and storing in Texas.
Well, what there again, another issue is, as you've touched on here, now the United States for some time now has been working on building a storage facility for high-level radioactive waste. And it, I believe it was supposed to be up and running by now and still is not because there are concerns about I think the concern is about the possibility that water could get into the site, even though that's in a desert. There's concern about water getting in there, that and that fact that one way or another, radioactive material could end up leaking out of the site and getting into the water supply for the area, and then have serious kinds of environmental health effects. And I think that at this point now, there have been so many questions raised about this site that some people wonder whether, in fact, it ever will operate.
That's a good question. And something like $50 billion is going to be spent on this process. An awful lot of that money is to protect a single well that's downstream that's used by a sheep farmer or a ranch. And the criteria for designing it says the government can't just go off and buy that farm and hold it forever. And say, okay, well, you know, we'll do the safe jobs we can, but we're not going to try to make sure that 10,000 years from there, nobody on that ranch ever drinks that water. And that's a strange thing to do, if you think about it, to have those design criteria. The basic reason is because the psychology of the design was, we're going to make this stuff go away forever so that nobody ever has to think about it again. Why would you want to do that? Well, it has to be because whether you said it explicitly or not, you're concerned about the plutonium again, because that's what's going to be left after that amount of time, mostly. And so trying to pretend that we can make this stuff go away forever without having the social instruments in place to keep it safe has driven this enormous cost. Otherwise, it would be considerably cheaper. And that was basically a mistake in the design setup.
Well, for I think for a lot of people, the fact that this in the extremely dangerous waste is produced and it's something that stays dangerous for a long time would be reason enough not to go with nuclear power at all. As an engineer, to you, is that reason enough to say that nuclear power doesn't make sense? Or do you, as an engineer, do you just approach that as an engineering problem and say, well, yes, this is a very serious problem, this waste that we're generating, but we should be able to figure out some way, if we decide that we need the power and all other things can be made to work, then do we say, well, this is something that we can figure out a way to do it?
Well, I direct a multidisciplinary program on arms control and national security, so I hardly take a simple technical view of this. All forms of human activity and all forms of energy production involve a certain amount of risk. And if you waste $50 billion doing something that you shouldn't have been doing, you could have spent $30 billion teaching all the women in Pakistan how to read. And then we'd have fewer people wanting to have too many children, and we'd have an educated populace that might not be so interested in nuclear weapons. There'd be a whole bunch of reasons why the future generations for hundreds of years to come will be a lot better off if we spent the money on that, rather than wasting it on a pipe dream that we can keep this stuff safe forever. Nobody ever has to think about it again.
Hmm. Well, we have some callers. Let's talk with them, bring them into the conversation, starting with someone listening in Savoy, and that's on line number one. Hello.
Oh, yeah, how you doing? Hey, you know, whenever you apply, you know, some common sense engineering principles and you just start doing, you know, very simple hazard analysis, the first thing you ask is, you know, what are the consequences or the extent of a disaster? And you go and you zero in on the worst thing that could happen. You go and you sit there and you look at it. And that's how you judge the hazard. And so, basically, there's no mitigation of this type of disaster. There's nothing you can do about it. Once it's loose on you, there's no countermeasure. And so, what people have tried to do is they go and they say, well, hey, let's apply some engineering. Let's apply layer upon layer of engineering controls. And in the end, whenever you do all the statistical analysis and you apply all of your engineering principles, it boils down to nuclear power plants have to be watched constantly. There's no engineering control that you can apply that make them safe, because they're inherently not safe by the fact that they must be watched constantly. And whenever you grasp that situation, then you go, well, the final control element is a human. And whenever you go and you look at the frequency of a human making a serious error, it's really bad. It's about 1 in 10,000. And so if you don't have really secure systems and humans that you can depend upon that will make the right decision at a critical moment, you'll have one boil over. And we've seen it happen now 2 times, and we're not sure of how many other times it's happened in the world either. So these plants they're inherently not safe, and you cannot make them safe. And, you know, that's the message that needs to get out to people. They're simply not safe for this reason.
Well, what do you think about that?
That there's no inherent safety in any method of energy production. Windmill turbines have got to be maintained and checked for fractures so that they don't fly off.
No, we're talking about the extent of the disaster here. If a windmill flies apart, it might throw a blade through somebody's house. We're talking about the extent of the disaster, and nothing would compare to a disaster happening up here at Clinton. There's nothing that could compare to it.
Well, that illustrates an important concept about risk perception.
Right.
I mean, there may be the expected value of somebody getting killed by a nuclear power plant may be one person in 100 years. And what that really means is that every 10,000 years, there's a chance that 100 people will get killed. Whereas there might be a higher risk from some other, well, coal is the best example. Coal is an extremely dangerous technology. People get killed all the time mining it and working in industrial plants and so forth. But those accidents, except for large-scale coal mining accidents, tend to occur on a smaller piece-by-piece basis than the maximum possible accident in a nuclear power plant.
Right.
So this is one of the things that the public has to make up its mind about collectively through its decision processes, is how important does it judge these sort of day-to-day risks with distributed energy technologies compared to the very small but potentially somewhat larger risk of a major meltdown and containment failure in a nuclear power plant.
Right, yeah. And, you know, there's been 2 examples of things that have gone really bad in really bad that we know about, or, you know, have been widely publicized. And I'm sure that in the Soviet Union, whenever you start digging around, you'll see examples of really bad accidents that were covered up. And you know, if we were to have another accident like Three Mile Island, or to have it go just a tiny bit further than it did, oh, man, you'd be toast.
Well, the industry would be toast anyway,
for
sure.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. And so, you know, it's a fool's errand, just from an engineering point of view.
I appreciate the comments.
We'll see you.
Well, thanks. Let's go on to somebody else. Let's go here to Champaign, and this is line number 2. Hello.
Hi. Not to sort of shift gears here from the safety concerns, but in terms of long-term storage of the plutonium waste, I've heard that, you know, something like a liquid metal fast breeder reactor can take that non-fissile plutonium and can make it into a fuel that can be used in another reactor, thereby solving this long-term storage problem, and that the waste from these reactors has a much shorter half-life, and is, you don't have to worry about storing it for 10,000 years. You only have to store it for, you know, a few hundred years. Am I incorrect in my understanding? And is the reason that this technology not being looked at more just a matter of the economics? Is it just too expensive to build these reactors right now?
That's right. There's been no success anywhere in the world with breeder reactor programs. The French, for example, spent had a large-scale breeder reactor. It ran about 10% of the time, and it cost more to decommission than a regular power plant costs to build. By several times. And so it really just seems completely out of the question that the industry or society as a whole in the foreseeable future is going to decide that the problem of radioactive waste storage hundreds of years from now is so important that we're going to spend 50% more for making electricity and invest in a technology which nobody has shown to work.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. To next caller, this is Danville, and it's line number 4. Hello.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. A couple of things. First of all, it was mentioned early on in the show about natural gas prices rising. Ironically, the rise in natural gas prices are attributed to the fact of the deregulation of the peaker plants that have gone in vast mm-hmm. numbers in this country. So to solve our short-term, or to give a short-term solution to a long-term problem, we've risen the price because, you know, these plants are the most inefficient plants of all. They're only about 30%. So now this drives the need and desire for nuclear power. I'd also like to say that, you know, it was stated that there is no power system that's inherently perfectly safe. But nuclear is the only kind of power that can kill for generations yet to come. Someone may die mining coal, or, you know, a boiler may blow up and kill a few people, but at least you're not killing or destroying genetic structures thousands of years in the future. Which also brings me to the final point, and that is the the long-term costs. We hear about nuclear power being so cheap and inexpensive, but yet how much, and this is my real question here, how much of the long-term costs are calculated into the cost of the energy that we're buying today?
Three questions in there. First, when it comes to long-term effects, one thing that you'll often hear people say is, and I think it's correct, is that coal plants put more radiation in the environment than nuclear power plants because they mobilize radioactive materials that otherwise be stayed in the ground, and they spread them all over plants everywhere, including tobacco, ironically enough, which has got big, broad leaves that tend to collect a lot of ash. There's long-term consequences from use of all sorts of different energy technology. Obviously, there's a tremendous long-term consequence from all the chemicals that are made by processing petroleum as well. There's a lot of waste that goes and stays in the ground for long-term, can potentially damage that. And the misallocation of resources, as I mentioned before, if you spent money educating women and they had fewer children, then we'd be using less nuclear power in the future, or less of all kinds of power in the future, and there'd be less consequences to future generations. So it's a balancing act. There's not a simple answer to that question.
But you mentioned that coal causes, did you say nuclear pollution?
Well, radioactive materials are dug out of the ground and mobilized and spread all over your crops when you burn coal.
But I've never seen anywhere where it actually causes gene mutation, which is what nuclear does.
It's known that if you take in radioactive materials and smoke, then your chances of cancer are higher.
But that doesn't mutate my offspring. It affects me. It affects the short term. But it doesn't affect 1,000 years from now when people are being born with three legs or four eyes or something. I mean, you know, you're talking about completely different situations here. One is the immediate of, yes, it can kill me or you or my neighbor. But, you know, you take Chernobyl. I mean, we're talking about vast tracts of the planet that will never, ever be inhabitable again. And the creatures who live in those areas are mutated. You don't get that with coal. You don't get that with oil.
Well, you get that by going out to Colorado and working in a mine, because your radiation exposure, if you live in Colorado, is a couple times what it is if you live elsewhere, and much larger than the difference is much larger than the average radiation exposure.
But if we stop that mining, it stops.
Well, but I could keep everybody from living in Colorado. What I'm trying to say is that the natural variation in radiation exposure is much larger than the differences that are ever likely to occur from the use of nuclear energy. And so if you think those things are important, then you ought to be looking at other sources of radiation exposure, of which the largest one to ordinary people is radon in their houses.
Right. Okay, thank you.
All right, let's go to another caller here. And maybe I should introduce again our guest just before we go on to the next caller. We're talking with Cliff Singer. He is professor of nuclear plasma and radiation engineering at University of Illinois. He's also director of the program in arms control, disarmament, and international security. We're talking about nuclear power. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Next up is a listener here in Champaign County, line number 3. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to go back to the specter of the worst case scenario and look at what industry and government have done together on that, which is the limitation of liability in the Price-Anderson Act. I think the new energy bill has some other kind of limitation of liability. So it seems to me that we wouldn't have the plants that we have now if it hadn't been for Price Anderson. So this is clearly a large subsidy, and it's also, you know, it should be political dynamite, because what it says is that industry is not willing to stand behind their technology enough to indemnify their own possible costs, that they have to go to the government to do that. And it's outrageous that they're considering even more of that. One thing I'd like to mention is that we haven't actually heard the word climate change or the expression climate change at all. I mean, you're trading off methane plants to nuclear plants. They are carbon emitters, and we need to do something about that very drastically. I think it's being used by the nuclear industry at this point, because and everything else that's coming out of the energy lobby is really very short-sighted as far as carbon emission goes. But what I'd like to propose is that one of the drawbacks to nuclear power is that there's no ability for decentralization, and that we have an economic system that prefers large plants where they like to socialize the capital costs in any way they can. But we need to decentralize the energy system, and I know that people are going to say, well, we don't have a plant down every block or something like that. But the point is that the other renewable systems are very good for decentralizing, which we lose the loss factor in distributing electricity over miles from central station. So that's more than a couple of things too. So I'd like to hear your comments on that. But the Price Anderson Act ought to be an outrage, and the fact that they're even considering more liability limitation goes beyond outrage, I guess I would say.
Yeah, I mentioned the overbuild in the industry in the 70s and 80s, and the Price Anderson Act was certainly one of the things that contributed a hidden subsidy to the nuclear power industry that was not available to other industries. Now, of course, there are other major subsidies to various other energy industries as well, and so the whole playing field needs to be leveled a bit on that. But, the industry really ideally would pool its liability somehow and take that risk on itself, and then that would be internalized back in a sensible way in the price of electricity. One of the problems is we've never had a court case. It's very difficult to figure out how the court system would deal with a major release of radioactivity, because it's so unlikely to happen that chances are we won't ever find out, and that makes it difficult for the insurance industry to figure out what the premiums really ought to be on such a thing. How much are people really going to get compensated if there's a release of radiation that makes a few thousand people evacuate their homes or whatever? We just don't know what the courts are going to do with that. As far as decentralization goes, that's useful in some places. About a half, say, of the country could use wind power, and that's more decentralized. A few places in Southern California may be able to use solar thermal electricity. Other parts of the country in the long run, when we move away from fossil fuels, are more likely to be appropriate to have centralized power. If you live in the Northeast, you've got a tremendously concentrated population there, and centralized power generation is not necessarily inappropriate for them.
I don't know where you get the 50% number, but it seems to me that I don't know if you're figuring in the gains from not having the losses, but you also haven't addressed the idea that there is a problem with the climate change, and that we can't just balance off a methane plant and a nuclear plant. We're going to have to go to all renewables. And the other aspect of proliferation, which you did mention earlier, is that it's just the height of, you know, we have already the situation where the nuclear weapons states are saying, do what we say, not what we do. But if we're, the first world is allowed to have its nuclear reprocessing, et cetera, and then also says, well, certain countries here, here, and here can't do it, I think there's an argument from politics to say that we should, as well as many other good ones, that we should start subsidizing research and the implementation of renewables, massive purchase of solar cells, a variety of designs by the Defense Department, et cetera, to try to bring the economies of scale into play on those, so I can have some solar shingles on my roof in the near term, as opposed to further along the line. Thank you.
All right. Any other comments?
Yeah, I went to visit a farm in Germany which had a windmill and a solar power cells on its roof, and talked to the guy who ran it, and he really loved the windmill, and he couldn't stand the solar cells because the windmill was making money for him and the solar cells were a sink. Now, I realize that the technology in both is developing, but I think we're more likely to see large-scale use of wind than photovoltaics, even after the research and development is phased in on that. If you want a grand solution, one way to approach this is for those countries that are already committed to nuclear weapons programs, and hopefully they'll build them down over the years, but they're still stuck with the radioactive materials they've made. That means the United States, Western Europe, China, and India in particular, those are the major carbon dioxide emitters in any case, that they in the long run, as they move away from fossil fuels, may rely on nuclear power. And in the meantime, they will subsidize research and development for themselves and for the rest of the world on renewable energy resources. Most of the poor countries in the world are in tropical areas, and in many cases, those are excellent places for solar power, for distributed systems, for biomass, and in some cases for wind. So there's a sort of grand bargain here where the major emitters of carbon dioxide take the risks of managing nuclear materials and basically, as a matter of foreign aid, subsidize the development of technologies for the rest of the world, and everybody ends up happy. We should be so lucky.
We have about 15 minutes left. Again, our guest in this hour, Focus 580, is Cliff Singer. He's professor of nuclear plasma and radiation engineering at U of I and is also director of the program in arms control, disarmament, and international security. Has been here before on the program, mostly, I think, to talk about issues related to nuclear weapons and proliferation. This morning we're talking about nuclear power generation. Questions welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Muncie is next. Muncie, Illinois. Next, line number 4. Hello.
Hello. I'd like to get back to the climate change and the global warming. The only reason I can see for going nuclear in a big way is to protect the species that are going to be lost forever due to this fossil fuel. And I was wondering if he could give an estimate on the number of nukes needed to actually drop the CO2 level, and if he would address the using nuclear to make hydrogen to get a fuel that could be used in transportation. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right.
Well, it depends how you do it. If you subsidize nuclear power and make electricity cheaper, then people will just use more energy altogether. So the nuclear energy is not the dog that wags the tail. Nuclear energy is the tail at the end of the dog. The dog is the increasing price of fossil fuels, accounting for some agreement on global warming, hopefully in the long run, that makes coal more expensive, and then people build more nuclear power plants. And if that happens, then basically we're going to need to substitute the coal plants for nuclear power plants. So instead of making 20% of our electricity from nuclear power, we're going to need to make like 40 to 50% from nuclear power. So that's the basic consequence of going down that road.
What about, I know that there are some people who are very enthusiastic about the idea of moving away from an economy based on fossil fuels to one based on hydrogen. However, then the question is, how are you going to generate the hydrogen? You can't just grab it out of the air. What do you think of the idea of using nuclear, using a nuclear reactor to make hydrogen, which you would then use, and you could use that in fuel cells, and you could use it to power vehicles and whatever else?
Well, right now, hydrogen's made from natural gas, which gets you nowhere in terms of fossil fuel dependence. There's most people know about hybrid cars, but one thing a lot of people don't know is that the Japanese version of a hybrid car, you can plug into your power outlet overnight. And then for a typical user in an urban environment, instead of getting 50 miles per gallon, you can get an average of 100 miles per gallon. If you did that here, you'd be using the Clinton power plant to run your car. You don't need any additional development. You don't need $1,000, $2,000 worth of platinum in your car and your fuel cell or more. You don't need all that complicated technology that nobody knows how to do right now. It's doable right here and now. Right here and now, we can reduce our need for fossil fuels for transportation by 50% over the next 5 to 10 years by switching to hybrid cars if that's the decision we made. We wouldn't have to import any oil from the Middle East, and we would be putting less carbon into the atmosphere. So hydrogen is basically, in my view, a pie-in-the-sky solution to an immediate problem. And it's the talk about hydrogen, at least in the medium term, 10 to 30 years, the talk about hydrogen is largely distracting us from dealing with the immediate solution that's already there and ready to go.
But then there's still the issue that we have to figure out how we're going to generate that electricity that is going to come from the plug when we plug in the car.
Right, and that's got to be a combination of wind, perhaps some solar thermal, nuclear in the long run. In the intermediate run, well, we're going to keep on doing what we're doing and make a gradual evolution in the real world.
All right, let's go to somebody on a cell phone here, line one. Hello.
You just answered one of my questions, but the other one is, I kind of get a sense that this is perhaps a bit unfair, but the sense of a lot of people about nuclear power seem to be getting their physics from Marvel Comics more than they are from, or their physics and biology from Marvel Comics more than they are from, physics and biology. And now there's no way that in a short amount of time you can clear that up, but although you've tried as you answer the questions, but do you know of good web resources? Because obviously the cost for getting those is very low. That would explain some of these things. I know the Federation of American Scientists, while they've been changing their web page around, often has some really useful stuff on various topics related to the more security type issues. But can you name anything like that that would be particularly useful? Because I think the problem is when these debates go rapidly off the rails when people start talking about four-eyed kids with eight legs and assorted other things, because, I mean, really, what is there to say to that? I just wondered if you could comment on that.
Go ahead.
Well, it's very rare that I actually get asked for a plug, but let me give it to you. If you go to our own website, www.actus.uiuc.edu, and you look in our courses there, you'll find one called Nuclear Engineering 201, and there's an extensive website there that explains a whole variety of things about a whole variety of energy sources, and there's a lot of good information there to start with.
Mm-hmm. Including environmental impact of radiation over long periods of time?
There's a little bit on that, not a lot.
Yeah. Well, again, we'll try to move on here. I have a number of other callers and the time that remains. And also I want to promise that this will not be the last program on the subject that we do. We'll be doing some others, and we'll try to get some different viewpoints in here and try and speak to all these various points. But for the moment here, we'll just keep moving on, see how many more people we can accommodate in the time that's left. And going next to a caller, I believe, in Chicago, line number two. Hello.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I hate to be a pessimist. Unfortunately, sort of similar to what your moderator was saying earlier, with the current administration, it seems dead set on opposing, any efforts at controlling the world's population. In fact, seems to want to see how big we can get the population before half the people die from something or another. It's almost inevitable that this is pushing an energy situation in a direction where you're going to have to go with nuclear power because the global warming thing is so out of hand. I mean, it's the one source of energy that doesn't create any global warming. I think it's almost inevitable it's going to happen. I mean, I personally would oppose it. I don't think letting private enterprise run something like that is just crazy. They've lied, they've cheated, and it's why so many people have misconceptions about it and don't trust it, because every time they were told something in the past, it was a total lie. But, unfortunately, I think that's where we're going to end up going. It's either that or we're going to have dire consequences of global warming. Either way, a lot of people are going to die. So that's all I got to say. Thank you.
All right. You want to comment on that?
Well, I think you've made a good point, is that largely because in the very long term, and we're talking about maybe second half of this century, because of the global warming problem, there is likely to be an expansion of nuclear power globally, whether we like it or not. And so it is very important, therefore, to figure out how to safely manage that, both in terms of the re-engineering of the plants and waste disposal, and also it's really extremely important that we have a global mechanism for securing all plutonium so that it's not used in additional weapons programs and to build down the amount of plutonium that's in the existing weapons programs.
All right, let's go to Chicago for another caller. This is line four. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I want to support the guy who just called from Chicago, but put it in terms that are really more dire than even he put it, and that is that we have just about 10 years to turn our policy around to eliminate the present method by which we produce energy. This is from a statement I read just within the last week or two by some environmentalist. He says, only 10 more years to go, and then the Earth is finished unless we change our fuel-producing policy. Anything that produces energy through production of CO2 will be a disaster, so we can't look at that form of energy production in any case. Another point to be made, and this is the and possibly not even that is sufficient, turning our energy policy around, because we have to face the fact that the Earth is overpopulated. Generally, the scientists consider that the ideal population for the United States is about 125 to 150 million. We now have 300 million. And for the Earth, it's about 2, 2.5 billion. We have 6 billion. And some way has to be found to reduce that population and to keep it from growing at the rate that it's been growing, and actually to decrease it by birth control methods. I think that's about all I have to say, unless you want to direct some question to me.
Well, let's say, again, we'll get a comment from Professor Singer.
Well, there's good news on the population front. The United Nations keeps revising downward its overall population projections. We used to think it was going through the roof and had no limit. Now we think that we're more than half the way to the maximum population we're going to have. That's still a tremendous challenge, partly because of agriculture, but mostly just because of providing the urban infrastructure that a lot of people are going to live with in the third world. As far as that comes back to the global warming question. One thing that people sort of think about global warming in a collective way without thinking about its impact on individual people. I mean, the impact in Illinois is that it's going to get a little warmer. We may be able to do double cropping in the south. Rainfall will probably stay about the same. Impact in Bangladesh is potentially horrendous. Lots of people living in floodplains that are going to have to move. And a lot of what needs to be done to deal with global warming is certainly to make it mitigate the amount of global warming that's going to happen. We're already committed to a certain amount of it. But also to provide educational resources and other infrastructure building resources so that the people in the countries most affected can adapt their lives to the increase in temperature in a way that's comparatively easy for us but otherwise might be catastrophic for them.
Okay, we'll try to get one more caller very quickly. Champagne, this is line three. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I live in Champagne, and Clinton is just about 45 miles away. They've got one nuclear power plant already, and they're talking now about building another. I would like to hear a comparison. If a Chernobyl-like incident happened right here in Illinois, in Clinton, just how long would it be before you could live in this area again, the most fertile farmland in the country? How long would it be before, I don't care about insurance settlements, I mean, what is the prospect if the worst happens?
Well, a Chernobyl-type accident wouldn't happen in Clinton because Chernobyl had a carbon core which burned and lofted a good fraction of the entire core into the atmosphere.
Well, what if a terrorist runs a plane into it?
Well, that's also not much of a problem. But the better example would be, suppose Three Mile Island-type accident happened and the containment had been breached. In that case, the radiation exposure would have been spread over the immediate area. And it just depends tremendously on how much of the radiation in the core gets mobilized. Most likely, it would be a fairly limited area that would be affected. Maybe if you live in Clinton, it wouldn't be a good thing. If the wind's blowing the wrong direction, Champagne's a different story. So these are low-probability events, but they're possible. It's also possible that some accident will happen in Russia and a nuclear weapon will drop somewhere in the United States, which would be a lot more serious consequence. So again, this is all a question of balance. You have to apply your resources to the various hazards that you face and try to maximize the overall benefit.
Well, at this point, my apologies for jumping in on the call, but we're going to have to stop just because we've used our time. We will be doing some other programs with other guests on the subject, so you'll hear some different points of view, again, have different opportunities to ask questions. So stay tuned. We'll stay continue to talk about the issue. For the moment, we will say thanks to our guest for today, Cliff Singer. He is director of the program in Arms Control, Disarmament, and International Security. He's also professor of nuclear plasma and radiation engineering at the U of I. Thank you.
Thank you.